what's important for campaigns and what I sort of wanted to dig into in my reporting was how they distinguish the sort of signal from the noise in all this and determine which of the lies online are actually worth taking seriously in electoral terms.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. We've been having this collective conversation about fake news, truth, lies, who gets to decide what falls into each category. This obviously includes conversations about terms like misinformation, disinformation, malinformation, and whether those terms are even useful. We've talked about how this changing information landscape impacts our vision for the country and the world. But today, we're going to look at that information ecosystem from the perspective of campaign professionals. What are the tactics and strategies that campaigns in the U.S. and abroad are using to fight and create the lies that influence the outcome of elections? Since we'll be talking about campaign strategy and how it's changing, I thought it'd be fun to have Mike Madrid ride shotgun with me today. As many of you know, he's my fellow co-founder of the Lincoln Project and is now a senior fellow at the UC Irvine School of Social Ecology. He's also a 300-year veteran of professional politics. Good morning, Mike. How you doing?
Good. It looks like 700, but it's only been 300. Campaign years on this body.
And today we're going to talk to a guy who spent a lot of his time studying what we do and is out with a fresh book about it. Sasha Eisenberg is a journalist and author. He's written books on topics ranging from globalization and sushi, medical tourism, and the struggle over same-sex marriage. He also wrote The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, which is a must-read for anyone interested in understanding how the modern mechanics of political campaigns have evolved. He's also a correspondent for Monocle, and he's got a brand new book out, The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. Sasha, welcome to Politicology.
Really glad to be here with you guys. Thanks.
So The Victory Lab comes out in, I think, 2012. Is that right?
That's right. Fall, right before the re-election.
That's right. Right before the re-election. And I don't know a single campaign professional who didn't read it. And so looking back on it now, from the vantage point of 2024, feels like a lifetime ago. What made you want to write The Lie Detectives and why now?
So I've thought back a lot to a question that I got when I was out talking about that book. And, you know, it was about a sort of scientific revolution that had taken place in campaigns between like roughly 2000, 2010. Two major innovations I was writing about, all the data that was becoming available to campaigns about individual voters and their ability to use like statistical modeling techniques to profile voters at an individual level. And then the use of field experiments, which for the first time allowed campaign professionals to sort of empirically test the effectiveness of things they do, you know, randomly assigned door knocks and stuff like that. And I would go out and give these talks and I would talk about sort of all the cool things that were happening on this cutting edge of campaigns, usually to for the purpose of becoming more efficient at registering and mobilizing voters or giving them targeting information to them that was thought to be more responsive to their interests. And like somebody would raise their hand and they say like, okay, so you told us about like all this interesting stuff that people are doing. What are the bad guys doing? And my answer was, they're not really using this. Like there are efforts to discourage people from voting. They're happening in the courts. They're happening in legislatures. But there were a lot of reasons why the folks who were trying to dissuade people from participating or confuse them were not really using these high-tech techniques. And then 2016 comes around. I watched what everybody watched. I also spent some time reporting on Donald Trump's sort of digital effort. I was writing for Bloomberg Businessweek at the time. And for the first time, I had to reckon with the idea that there were people who were using sort of some cutting-edge campaign tools for the purposes, for ill, to confuse and mislead voters. And that, in the last few years, that really came to strike me as sort of the cutting edge of, the new cutting edge of innovation in campaigns is, okay, well, you're on the other end of this. You're a candidate, you're a party committee, you're a super PAC. Your opponent now isn't necessarily another candidate or party. Your candidate could be somebody who's sort of outside of the conventional constraints of the political process in the United States. How do you deal with that asymmetric environment?
So I want to talk about that for just a minute before we dig in, because it's, I think, the only vignette you tell in the book that's right of center. Everything else focuses on the left. There's probably a good reason for that, which you can explain. But this story from the Trump campaign 2016 stood out to me because I knew a guy who was working with the team at the time, and the night before, two nights before the election, texted me, was like, they think they're going to lose. The whole data department thinks they're going to lose, right? And they did. This has been well documented since then. What was going on that you saw that was so different from what campaigns had done before? And this probably segues to, you know, some of the international work that you highlight that that this character, G.R. Craig, sort of brought into the Democratic ecosystem.
Yeah. So, you know, I co-authored a couple pieces with Josh Green, who was my colleague at Bloomberg at the time. And we quoted a senior Trump campaign official talking about voter suppression efforts that they said were underway. And frankly, I was skeptical. And this campaign official showed us videos. One of them was Hillary Clinton, a cartoon version of Hillary Clinton's comment about super predators that they said they were targeting via Facebook dark post to like young African American males in Miami-Dade County or whatever. And I was skeptical that they were actually doing this, because one of the things I learned during my period covering the Trump campaign is they were liars, not just like what they said to voters, but what they said to journalists about what they were doing and how. And so I did not take at face value that they were actually spending money to do what they said that they were doing. But it was the first time that I had encountered in my reporting somebody using the language of sort of the modern high-tech campaign for the purposes not of trying to persuade voters or mobilize them or register them, but to try to demotivate, to turn people away from the process. And that is what, from that experience, really clicked with me. So it wasn't that they were doing necessarily that they had some technical capacity that other people didn't have. It was that their motives or ambitions were sort of at odds with what I was used to covering in campaigns.
Yeah, Mike, this story stood out because to me, the tactics that they were using were just trying to depress turnout. And in campaigns, we know that there is a very clear line between suppression and depression. And what stood out to me was that the Trump staff were just so stupid to say, we're suppressing the vote, instead of we're running a voter depression operation on our advertising. You want to talk about the difference between those two things and how they're deployed by campaigns?
Yeah, well, the Trump campaign wasn't sending their best, so we have to remember that. But look, and I think the term suppression has been bandied about so much, it has almost kind of lost its meaning, at least from a professional standpoint. There has always been, as long as I've been in the business, on both sides, this attempt to kind of, well, negative advertising itself is designed to raise the negative sentiments of the voter so much that they're less inclined to vote. Doesn't mean that necessarily you're going to vote for my candidate because you don't like the other person. You just might not vote at all. And that is a part and parcel of why negativity is a tool in the weapon of the political consultant on both sides. Now, you know, 300 years ago, when I was a young guy in the business, as Ron says, I mean, this was usually a late term tactic that was used as voting was about to begin, in large part because the campaigns couldn't, you know, respond. Today, it's more often than not that the negative attack is the way you start your campaign, because of the way voters have been preconditioned to kind of be open to the negativity in our political discourse. But again, the idea of voter suppression happening, you know, at long lines in a lot of these communities, especially people of color in the South, does that happen? It does. Is that the common way to do this? No. The technologist has been able to scale this nationwide by simply using these messages. And so hearing Sasha talk about these targeted messages of Hillary Clinton saying something that would be offensive to the community as a way of raising her negatives is essentially what we historically have called a depression effort to limit the rate of turnout of a base vote of the opposition's party. Whether or not that's suppression, I guess we could kind of discuss, but they are getting are more seamless, and the suppression technique is becoming more ubiquitous. It's becoming more integrated into the campaigns. It's becoming common. Those are the things that we used to hush hush talk about in the back room. Now, you know, got young political consultants that just specialize in it.
Yeah, well, this is part of what we did in 2020 for Trump voters. There were specific campaigns designed to discourage Trump voters and make them, you know, not so excited to go out and vote for Trump, which had an effect of you know, them staying home.
And obviously, I should say, like, you know, with such a polarized and sorted electorate, it makes sense strategically to think about more of your campaign being focused on how you can shrink the opposition coalition than it would have been in an era where, you know, a large share of the electorate were ticket splitters or switchers, and you know, were thinking far more about persuasion there.
We're not persuading as much anymore. That's exactly right.
So in the intro, I love this, you invoke the comic, which I think everybody knows, by Randall Monroe, but there's a guy at a computer saying to his significant other who's calling to him from the other room that he can't go to bed because someone is wrong on the internet and he's out there to correct them. Which is fine, right? Someone being wrong or just outright lying isn't a new phenomenon in professional politics, but the whole book is about mis, dis, malinformation, whatever you want to call it. Someone is wrong on the internet. It's the theme that runs through the whole thing. So what do you think makes someone being wrong on the internet a particular challenge to campaigns now in a way that it didn't used to be?
When I set out to write this a couple years ago, I realized that there had been a fair bit written about disinformation as a problem for democracy, as a sort of society level problem, as a geopolitical tool. There's been some good investigative reporting on the people who are producing disinformation and why. There's lots written about what the platforms, the social media platforms, could or should be doing to handle it. The one part of this that had been missing was this question that's really interesting to me, and to people in your line of work, which is, if you're on the receiving end of this while running for office or being involved in an electoral campaign, what do you do? How do you decide when to engage and what do you do to engage? And, you know, they tell me that it's always great to unpack a joke and explain every last part of it, but why that cartoon is funny is there are a lot of people wrong on the internet all the time about everything. And to keep on beating this thing, if you spend your time trying to correct everybody who's wrong on the internet, that's all you'll do always. That's not an option for campaigns. They need to correct some of the things that are wrong on the internet. Ultimately, a very small share of the things that are wrong on the internet matter to campaigns. But they have incredibly high stakes and demands, making sure that they are identifying which of those things that are wrong on the internet require a response and figure out how to respond to them so that they are not affirming or amplifying the existing lie. And so people talk about the responsibility that the social media companies have, the governments might have, that civic institutions might have at reducing disinformation online. And that's a sort of broad cultural civic responsibility. Campaigns have a self-interest in just rebutting the lies that will hurt them. And frankly, one thing I saw as I spent time talking to people is, to them, it doesn't really matter whether something that's being spoken about them is true or false. It just matters whether an attack is potentially damaging. For them, that the core objective is distinguishing between, I think, so many of the examples of disinformation that we see sort of elevated, often through media, who are like, today's story is like, there's a crazy deep fake about X or Y. You know, we found it on TikTok. Let's show it to you. So many of those are circulating among people who either are non-voters, can't vote in the jurisdiction that you're running an election, are circulating among your side's opponents whose vote choice is already locked in, are not persuasive to the small share of voters who might be persuadable. And so what's important for campaigns, and what I sort of wanted to dig into in my reporting, was how they distinguish the sort of signal from the noise in all this and determine which of the lies online are actually worth taking seriously in electoral terms.
Yeah, those lies can sometimes be so tempting to respond to. There's a matrix that I can't remember if it was G.R. Craig who came up with it or somebody who was interpreting her instructions, but basically in the top left quadrant is do nothing, And, you know, then there's a various, you know, range of possibilities, ways you might choose to respond to disinformation. But it seems to me like most of her work with candidates and campaigns was on getting them to do nothing, essentially. I have had the unpleasant, never run for office, never going to run for office, but I have had the unpleasant experience of being the subject of lies online, as I know other you guys have. What is it like now to try and get, how has that changed the dynamic between sort of communications professionals on a campaign and the digital staff who are often charged with, you know, monitoring online advertising and what's going on Twitter? How have those relationships changed, and are the candidates, the principals themselves, becoming sort of less sensitive to all kinds of false information circulating about them online, or is that still a major challenge?
Yeah, I think that there's a sort of, you know, the principal and the staff have some very divergent interests and instincts when it comes to this stuff. So I spend a chapter in the book writing about the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which during the 2020 cycle created a counter disinformation task force that was basically serving as a hub for research, tracking, and advice to all their candidates in battleground districts. And I have the scene of Sherry Bustos, who was then the chairwoman of the campaign committee, bringing together members at a dinner. And say, I want to introduce you to the people who are running this new disinformation task force. And everyone goes around the table, these members of Congress, and they talk about their personal experience with disinformation. And it tends to fall into two groups. These are Democrats in early 2019. They're either people who have a personal experience of being attacked online or seeing rumors circulate about them or their party, you know, members from Florida who are being accused of being socialists and sympathizers of you know, autocratic left-wing governments in Venezuela or wherever. And the other group, and there's some overlap, are people who have been in a certain way radicalized by Trump's election, the Mueller investigation, the knowledge that has come out post-2016 about the role, particularly that the Russian Internet Research Agency played in helping Trump online. And so you have some of these members are thinking about this in very personalized ways, and others are thinking about this in geopolitical terms, which is not a conversation that when the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee says, like, I want to introduce you to our new, you know, small dollar fundraising lead, that people come with like all this baggage about like, how are we going to do this? Or like, let's introduce you to our, right, our, you know, the people doing our micro-targeting models. Like, people brought a lot of like heavy stuff to these conversations. And it made this advice of do nothing, which most of the time is the right advice if somebody is lying about you on the internet, very difficult to convey to the ultimate decision makers in campaigns, because they were all motivated by this feeling that this is a major threat to democracy, to American national security, and we need to do something. And so the kind of, you know, and this was, versions of this were, even on non-disinformation issues, were sort of like rife on the left in that period, you know, kind of resistance era energy. It's like everybody felt like they needed to do their part. And the problem with disinformation is that often doing something, or doing something in the wrong way, can be not just a waste of your time and resources, but counterproductive, right? We have all this cognitive psychology research that suggests that if you deny a lie by saying, no, I am not in Paris to eat all the croissants that have been baked at the patisserie today, people might be inclined to suspect that you've spent your day gouging on croissants. There's also just the sort of structure of the internet, which is that you know, social media algorithms are drawn up to reward engagement, and that if you try to counter or correct or push back on a post or piece of content, you can often end up amplifying and helping to spread it. And so that this is the difficult decision it's to make is when to do nothing. And the job of people like Jory Craig and others in her role was to develop the tools and data to help campaign decision makers. And we're not just talking about the candidate, but the campaign manager, the comms director, the people who hour to hour have to decide what are we talking about and where and how, the confidence to know that doing nothing was the tactically sound move. And that required both like developing this tools and data, but also getting this cultural shift underway for people to understand that some of the old rules of political communication don't apply the same way to the digital environment.
I'm curious also about the nature of the sort of changing guard in terms of who's more knowledgeable and who's maybe advice you ought to be taking when it comes to coming up with a communication strategy and being disciplined about it, where that used to be sort of the you know, Mike, you and I know the communications directors who have, you know, they pace the floor with a baseball bat over their head while they're talking to reporters, thinking that they can control everything that's ever said about their candidate, right? Those are the guys who are not used to really relinquishing control on a campaign to the kids over there with their newfangled technology who are sort of monitoring what the entire world is saying about you. So I wonder, I mean, both of you really, Mike, how have you observed this sort of on the Republican side, this changing of the guard and the incentive structures, you know, fee structures being threatened by technology, but also what was it like watching this transformation take place on the Democratic side as you were studying these candidates, Sasha? Mike, you want to go first?
Yeah, look, this is a really fascinating conversation because just as somebody who's, you know, paces around talking to reporters and running the comms drill and trying to control the narrative all day, and have seen how both sides operate. Let me say this, you know, back, and I think the narrative was really in the Dukakis Bush campaign in 88. Sorry to go back a little bit, but when Republican attacks started coming in, and the Dukakis people were like, this stuff is so absurd, we're not even going to respond to it. And of course it crushed him and brought him down. A new narrative started in the Democratic side of the aisle, which is if you're not responding to it, then people are going to start accepting it as true. And so a culture of automatically responding to all of these charges set in. And with technology, that's not the case today. In fact, tactically, the only way to respond or deal with the situation is not only to ignore it to the extent that you can, it doesn't snowball huge, but to launch your own offensive to the other side to drive the narrative. You're not trying to bracket the way we used to and limit the damage. You kind of parry the attack and start going on the offense as quickly as you possibly can to start muddying the waters. And I'm not saying a lie. I'm just saying use whatever attack lines you have to keep your opponent on defense. And that's the best defense is a good offense, essentially, is what it's become. And I think that that's a dramatically different shift in the way that information flows in campaigns. Now, I want to give a slight variation, an example of how difficult it is to respond in a political environment. But we've got a really great example from this weekend, when Katie Britt gives a response to the State of the Union and lies about the story of the undocumented immigrants' story. Now, it wasn't the Democrats who responded. It was this former AP investigative and journalist who was like, wait, this story doesn't add up, who was on TikTok, started to find this stuff and realized, hey, this story is not true. And within 12 hours, the entire national narrative had shifted on Katie Britt from, hey, wait a second, this is a really bad performance. She did a really bad job in terms of her tone and delivery, to this is just an outright lie with that attack. But again, that was not, and the way that manifested itself was fascinating to me because it was not a response from the Democrats. It just happened to be somebody else that was out there. And more often than not, if I'm the Democrats, I'm sticking with what works, which is her delivery and her tone were really bad and attacking her performance, not spending the time, effort, energy, and resources to do the fact checking as to whether the story was actually true. That was somebody totally on the outside. So, I'm saying a couple of different things here. I'm just trying to give an example of what this environment, the political battlefield looks like.
the Democrats, I think, were doing the right thing by attacking the tone and the style and the breathiness and the overacting that was getting them far enough. But it took somebody from the outside to say, hey, wait a second, it's not just a crazy performance art here. This is not true. And then that took on a life of its own, but that never would have come from the Democrats because it doesn't make sense to actually focus on the time, effort, and energy to determine whether or not the story is true. Use whatever attack line you have to advance, regardless of the veracity of the claim. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Go ahead, Sasha.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of the other dynamics that are sort of underway in this generational shift, this tension, Ron, that you point out between sort of the old guard communications minds in both parties, right? And folks who were fundamentally, you know, trained and raised in an era of broadcast media, where both paid and free, right? So if you were running campaigns in a decision-making role between, like, you know, 1970 and 3 weeks ago, you thought about the dominant vectors of communication as being your paid television and to a lesser degree radio, and maybe broadcast mostly, probably, but some cable, whatever. But the dynamics were basically the same. And free media that was running primarily through television news and newspapers and maybe news weeklies. And that inculcated, even in an unspoken way, I think, for among the people who were raised in that environment, a few assumptions that are no longer true, but I think, you know, remain the sort of controlling assumptions. One is, we can see everything. So, you know, television advertising is kind of nuts. Like, you could go to the station and see a log of every single ad that was posted, that was aired everywhere, exactly, to the minute. You know, we don't have that level of visibility into direct mail. We don't have that level of visibility into robocalls. We don't have that visibility into most of the stuff that's online. And so that's the first thing. So it gives you the sense of omniscience. Like, I could see the whole communications landscape. And so that when I make a decision about when to respond or how to respond, I'm doing it with kind of perfect knowledge of who's seen it and at what volume or intensity. And then the other thing is that you can hold accountable the speaker. So if a TV ad runs that is attacking Mike Dukakis for being a member of the ACLU or you know, letting Willie Horton on furlough, you can try to hold accountable the people behind it. In this case, it was a political action committee. You can try to get, you know, you can go to the editorial board of the Washington Post and try to get them to, you know, to scold the people who put it out. You can, you know, roughly where it aired. So you can try to make sure that in those markets, you're getting free media that tries to correct the impression, you know, if and when you do push back. But now we're in an environment where there's very little of that transparency just about what's out there and who's possibly seeing it, number one. And number two, if the message is being promoted, disseminated, not by a candidate's campaign or a political action committee or a party or an elected official, but by some Macedonian teenagers who are creating fake news website so that they can sell ad traffic against it, or the anonymous person in a basement who just wants his or her memes to get amplified because they think it's cool, or a group of people who just sort of want to create mischief and chaos online, or a foreign intelligence service. You can't, like, they don't care what the editorial page of the Washington Post scolds them about. And so I think a lot of the comms playbook was predicated on this idea of, okay, there's a bad story, however it comes out. Do we respond? If we respond, maybe we turn a one-day story into a two-day story or a three-day story. But if we think the story was fundamentally unfair or inaccurate, part of the pushback will be we can get our opponent identified as a liar by some, like, you know, central institution that will help to damage my opponent because now their credibility has been harmed. None of that works in an environment where your opponent is not your opponent and or your opposition isn't your opponent. And so, but I think that shift of mindset, if you've been running campaigns for 30 years where you sort of, you know, okay, well, 1,000 points in the Columbus market means we should try to get some pushback in the Columbus Dispatch. Like, that's useless experience right now. And it's people who have come up in an age of totally decentralized media. It's not so much a digital analog divide. I think it's like centralized versus decentralized media is sort of the fundamental divide. And often that falls on generational lines, but not always.
Can I jump in here? Because this is really fascinating. Yeah. I would love to get Sasha's sense of this. Prior to 2016, the one thing we never, ever attacked our opponents on was being a liar. Like, you didn't say that. And the press, even at debates, would say, are you calling your opponent a liar? And people go, well, no, I'm not saying he's a liar. I'm just saying that he might be bending the truth a little bit or blah, blah, blah. But you, there was a social cost to calling somebody a liar that everybody was afraid to cross that line. Today, calling somebody a liar is the least of what we start with this idea, right? The public square has eroded where everybody assumes everybody's sort of lying. And so there's not a social ostracization guardrail anymore to keep people honest. And one of the most horrifying things I've seen is young political consultants. There's no, like, I'm not saying all of them, but a lot of them are just not inclined to be like to play around the same parameters that I used to when I was their age. Like, I am being that old guy again, right? But it's like the art of the political consulting was persuasion. And in an environment where everybody is presumed to be a liar, the skill set of persuasion changes to mobilization and anger. So even if I am calling somebody a liar, as a Democrat or the media calling somebody out saying, well, that was a lie, it's having literally no effect in the trajectory of the campaign, except for perhaps to solidify my own lying candidate or my own lying campaign to say, oh, these guys are good at attacking the other side. I'm with those guys. And so that's that to me is the cultural breakdown, the cultural guardrails. It's first of all, to your point, it's impossible to track this stuff. Even if you could track this stuff, it's so atomized, the media environment, that you don't know where to respond or how to respond or if it's effective to respond. But the third part is our culture is kind of okay with it. We kind of like, we've lost this shame of being a liar to where there's almost a virtue in it. So I don't know how you correct for that. I'd love to hear your thoughts on one, if you agree with me, if I'm just being crazy, or two, what do you do in that environment?
Yeah. I mean, I think elected officials and candidates are more brazen now about lying. You know, I think there are senators who are willing to say things on camera or online that are so immediately falsifiable. Look, I've written a book basically now about lying in politics, and let's like step back for a second and say, like, politicians have always shaded the truth.
Right.
Some of them have lied. They've exaggerated. I don't want to pretend like that something, you know, that lying was invented in 2016 or we didn't have some version of disinformation. I think what's changed is, I do think, and I think this is something that's pretty easy to directly pin on Donald Trump and you know, the waves of impact that he has had, particularly within his party, but maybe not exclusively, is that politicians are willing to cross lines that they weren't before. I think that the reputational harm is thought to be less, or the gain is thought to be worth the damage. I mean, if you think about what constrained, look, we don't have any laws in the United States that stop politicians from lying, right? Or punish them for it. So why pre-2016, Mike, was it so unusual for, you know, and so politicians would exaggerate, they would shade the truth, they would decontextualize things for advantage. Part of the reason you didn't call your opponent a liar was that it seemed hyperbolic for you to call somebody a liar when we sort of accepted all politicians presented things in ways that benefited them, but stayed within some bounds of like falsifiability, I guess. What I think has changed is that the rewards to lying are thought to be greater, small dollar fundraising, online attention, all the sort of short-term, like slot machine style rewards of modern politics, that the more outrageous you are, the better you do. And I think that the costs, which tended to be longer term, at least have yet to manifest themselves. I mean, Trump's always had a very short-term sense of cost-benefit analysis, right? Whatever gets me through the hour, whatever gets me through the day, he's managed to string together enough, by his measure, good days in a row that, you know, it's kind of staggering. But most politicians are not thinking about the hour or the day. They're thinking about, you know, I want to serve in this body for another 10 or 20 years and move up to be a committee chairman and go into leadership, or I'm a backbencher in the House and I want to be able to run for governor. And the old rewards and incentives were such that, you know, yeah, it might hurt you with voters if you're identified as a liar, but also like your colleagues will maybe not want to collaborate with you as much on legislation if they think you're untrustworthy. Your donors might not want to be associated, you know, might think less of you if the editorial page is always calling you a liar. You know, interest groups that might endorse you will feel some sense of tarnish if you're going to embarrass them by this. And there's still a lot of politicians who are thinking on a time horizon that values that. But we see far more who've sort of weighed things differently and are willing to cross lines. The other thing that's changed, you know, and we've been talking mostly in the context of Katie Brint and Donald Trump about politicians, office holders, or candidates. It's all the other categories of people who now have the ability to communicate at scale and at scope at close to zero cost. I sort of went through the Macedonian teens and the you know, meme making thrill seekers and the foreign spies and all of these people, but like, you go back 10 years and you couldn't be part of the political conversation at any scale without being a sort of legitimate political entity, a campaign, a party that registered with the FEC, was under a whole bunch of constraints by campaign finance law, under a whole bunch of constraints by the tax code. If you put a television ad on the state that had lies in it, the station would get a takedown letter and you'd spend a bunch of money on lawyers and your ad would get pulled off the air. So there was a sort of internal economy that required certain accountability in political speech. And now the people who are often introducing ideas into the conversation and amplifying and spreading them are not constrained by those things. And so they certainly don't, you know, the Macedonian teens certainly aren't thinking about how am I going to get a committee chairmanship in the Senate in 10 years. We also don't even know their names. So how would you even try to like shame them and hold them accountable? And so I think that that is just like what it took to communicate with people. You know, I think back a lot. I have this example in the book. What is probably the dominant, you know, the last big example of pre-digital disinformation that got sort of society-wide awareness were the attacks on John McCain before the South Carolina primary in 2000. McCain had a daughter he adopted from Bangladesh. There were these rumors that went around that she was an out-of-wedlock child of his. The reporting suggested that this went out by robocall in South Carolina and that there were some flyers that were placed under church park windshield wipers in church parking lots. It's worth just thinking about like technologically what that took. Like you needed a photocopier. The photocopier needed to be pretty close to the church parking lot. You needed people who could be available at a given time on a Sunday morning who could like walk around. You were only going to reach so many people that way. Now you want to put out a message and get it seen by tens of thousands or millions of people pretty quickly. You don't have to be anywhere near the people you want to reach. You don't even need as much technological infrastructure as a Xerox machine. You don't need manpower more than one person who can put something out there. And so you just have, you know, we valorized 13 years ago in Tahrir Square when one person could tweet with no barriers to entry, you know, come join the revolution. And now we're seeing the consequences of this, those same barriers being lowered and the people who are entering the political conversation are doing so with a different set of aims. And it just means that we have, you know, we've democratized political communication, but it means you have a lot of speakers who don't have any accountability or not subject to any constraints.
I want to go back to something you said earlier and just underscore it, because one of the disincentives or the negative incentives to lying so egregiously, as you said, used to be that maybe your donors would think less of you, right? And holding up online fundraising as a particular example of like the egregious kind of lies that people will say. People will say unhinged things in your email inbox that they would never actually say out loud, even in 2024, on both sides, all over the place. And I think this underscores the sort of the walls coming down, as you said, because they don't need to go to the, you know, max out donors anymore. What can you give? $2,800, $3,600? What are we up to now? They raise it $100 every cycle or so. Like the most a wealthy donor used to be able to give to a campaign was, you know, a couple thousand dollars at most. And now you write an unhinged email and send it out to a list of a million people and suddenly you raise $1 million. So it's almost not worth the effort to go and do these high dollar fundraising tours that the finance consultants used to put together for you, because the return on the cost of fundraising is just so high. And as a result, the negative incentive for being a crazy person is so diminished because of how much money you can raise on the internet. Because as you said, the walls have come down.
Yeah, no. And I think that you know, political actors are operating just in a totally different environment about what is, you know, and they don't care whether the local, you know, newspaper says that they're a liar either. I mean, that used to be a big constraint on the behavior of both office holders, candidates, and campaign strategists. Like, you know, people in Mike's line of work would push the envelope on things, but being called a liar was something that you wanted to avoid as a political operative. You're happy people would say you would do anything to win, that you're an intense competitor, that you know how to frame things to your candidate's advantage. But that was like, that would go too far. Reputationally, that would be, and, you know, now you have people like Steve Bannon, whose whole theory of political change is...
tear it all down.
I mean, yeah, tear it all down, flood the zone with shit, yeah. I believe is his yeah. line. Like, yeah. Where that's his strategic... His core strategic insight is that there are huge advantages to lying tactically. And so, yeah, I think we're just a totally different environment for decision makers.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. And make sure you're subscribed so you get notified when the second part of this conversation drops next week. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover the show organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.